Welcome to the Book Show. Novelist and essayist Francine Prose has spent decades exploring the beautiful mess of human behavior. Her new novel, 5 Weeks in the Country, revisits the famously awkward 1857 visit of Hans Christian Andersen to Charles Dickens's home, a literary houseguest situation that spirals into comedy, tension, and emotional chaos. Francine Prose is next on The Book Show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Over a career spanning more than 24 books, Francine Prose has written acclaimed novels like Blue Angel, The Vixen, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris 1932, while her nonfiction classic Reading Like a Writer became essential reading for aspiring authors and devoted readers alike. Her new novel, 5 Weeks in the Country, turns a strange real-life literary episode into this rich, darkly funny fiction. In the summer of 1857, Hans Christian Andersen arrives at Charles Dickens' country home for what should have been a brief visit. Instead, he doesn't leave. He stays 5 excruciating weeks wandering into a household already strained by Dickens's collapsing marriage, a restless ambition, and a growing fascination with a young actress. The result is just a great, wonderfully awkward story, a very moving story about genius and ego and loneliness and these disasters that often unfold behind literary celebrity. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome Francine Prose back to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. It's always a great pleasure to talk to you.
I will admit that I had never heard this novel was presented to me, but at what point did it come on your radar that Hans Christian Andersen had this visit to Charles Dickens's house?
I knew about it for a very long time. I mean, it's been out there. And also, I've read several biographies of Dickens and one of Andersen, and it's always sort of a footnote in the biographies. You know, this was just a week in a difficult summer, or 5 weeks in a difficult summer. And I thought, gee, this is more than a footnote. I mean, that these two great geniuses with wildly divergent personalities at different points in their lives and their careers should come together and make each other miserable for 5 solid weeks. Like, how come no one had really written about that before?
So this is, and you talk about this at the beginning of the book, but this does happen. But as you note, it includes real people and documented events, but takes significant liberties with detail and chronology. What I found surprising is the things that I thought were really strange turned out to be the things that were absolutely true.
That saying, you can't make this stuff up, that always turns out to be true. I mean, the thing that seems so perfect or so outrageous or so, I mean, for example, Dickens, who was fallen in love with a much younger woman, allegedly was busted by the rest of his family when he meant to send his beloved a very fancy bracelet from a jeweler in London, and it got delivered by accident to the wrong address, that is his wife. You know, the truth came out. And again, it, you know, it would be the kind of thing a novelist would need to make up to have the, you know, as a way of having this information be revealed. But history had done it for me.
One of the things about it is that when Hans Christian Andersen comes to visit Charles Dickens, it's actually quite a while after they met and the invitation was initially made, correct?
Yeah, they met 10 years before. And I mean, the other kind of thing I did with history was that, in fact, Andersen had visited the Dickens family once before at the seaside. And I guess he hadn't stayed that long, and the family wasn't in as much trouble. And that visit had gone more or less well. But they did meet 10 years before. And the thing was that they met at a dinner party, and the two of them got quite drunk at the dinner party. So even though Anderson didn't speak English. They had both drunk enough to imagine that they were speaking the same language and could communicate and have a deep conversation about literature and art and blah, blah. So then when Anderson actually showed up at the Dickens household in 1857, even though he'd taken 6 weeks of English lessons in Denmark, those lessons hadn't done very much. And so he couldn't speak. So he was just essentially mute and was not only awkward by nature and intensely self-conscious just by character, but he couldn't speak. But over those difficult 5 weeks, he learned, because it's easier to learn language from children. I mean, people who are nannies or au pairs in a different country too. So he learned a certain amount of English from the kids. So by the end, he could kind of communicate with the children and with poor Catherine Dickens. But he was so in awe and so frightened, really, of Dickens himself, and so taken with him. So, he was kind of in love with him in a way that he couldn't speak in Dickens's presence. So he would just go mute until the very, very end of the novel, where he finds something to say, and it's absolutely the wrong thing to say.
One of the things that keeps coming up, at least in my mind in reading it, is that you just wonder why this any invitation was ever given, because Dickens just, yes, the marriage is dissolving, he has his own problems, but it just seems miserable the entire time. He's trying to skirt around the house and not have anything to do with this fellow. And which you would think the natural conclusion to that would just be a tap on the shoulder and say, okay, I think it's time for you to go.
I think that he was in that one of the reasons that he may have been invited at this point was as a kind of distraction. I mean, that is, you have a guest who's just drawing fire from everyone in the family as being the most annoying person ever, might distract everyone from the fact that dad is falling apart and dad is gradually separating himself from the household. So there's that. And in fact, it did work that way. And the children ranged in age. I mean, there were nine surviving children, so they ranged in
Right.
age from 5 to 20. The children, except for the youngest, were intensely annoyed by Anderson and everything he did and felt that he was, I mean, people who've had guests for long periods of time know the feeling of like you walk into a room and the person is there no matter what room you walk into. And that was the children's experience. And they were most happy when the parents and Anderson would go to London and just leave them on their own for a while.
The kids, who are basically preteen and teenagers, they are quite unimpressed by this gentleman and ultimately refer to him as the Danish person. And it doesn't really grow deeper than that.
No, well, the thing is that Anderson has sent Dickens a collection of his fairy tales, which had been translated into English by then. And whether or not through forgetfulness or hostility or any combination of the two, Dickens has neglected to bring the book home to his family. And Anderson had naturally assumed that he had children, so the children would be given the fairy tales. And so when Anderson arrives, he, of course, assumes that the children will be in awe of the great author of fairy tales, and they have no idea who this guy is, except, another weird fan of their father's who has come to their house inexplicably.
And speaking of inexplicable, I mean, so he comes in and then when he really was the first time that he raises a red flag to Dickens is when he tries Hans Christian Andersen tries to kiss him, and he just doesn't know what to make of that.
No, certainly there were differences in manners and behavior from the continent to England. And there's a lot made of them. This is how they do it on the continent. This is how they do something in Denmark. This is how they don't do it in England. So the sort of affection, I mean, if he were to kiss someone in France, let's say, on both cheeks, it wouldn't be a horrifying intrusion. But this happening in a British household just completely freaked everybody out. Just a horrible thing to do.
The name of the novel is 5 Weeks in the Country. Tell us a little bit about Gad's Hill.
It was about 27 or 27, 30-ish miles southeast of London. You could reach it by train. And Dickens had seen the house as a child because they lived in Chatham for a while when he was a little boy. And the story Dickens told his family that when he was a child, he would walk past the house with his father and see this large house on the hill and wonder who lived there. And then he returned to the area, many years later, by now a famous writer and rich one, realized that the house was for sale. And not only that, but it was owned by a woman who contributed to one of his journals. So he was able to buy it. And it was his dream of recreating the lost paradise he never had. Because Dickens himself, of course, his father wound up in the debtor's prison, and Dickens spent a good part of his childhood in extreme poverty in the prison, and then working in the blacking factory, sitting in the window and filling bottles of ink, basically, while people walked by and laughed at him. So this was a kind of reach for the life he dreamed of. And the idea was to give his children, of course, a common idea that we all have to give one's children the life the parents never had, or so that was his idea. Meanwhile, the children did not want to be in the country. They missed London. Their friends were in London. Their freedom was in London. No one liked it. Dickens himself was kind of disgruntled the minute he got there and was wound up in staying in London a lot. So it was the first sign that the dream life of living in the country in the big house was not actually going to work out that well.
The way the story is told, and it begins being told by one of the children, a child that you do not identify, I should note.
Well, actually, it's told by all of the children. That's, I mean, there's no, it's a collective voice. I don't know who told, I really don't know
Yes.
which one. And I couldn't, I mean, part of the reason I did it that way was I just couldn't decide which of the children would tell the story because, a story told by a 5-year-old and a story told by a 20-year-old
Very
would
different.
be quite different. But also, it's impossible to figure out because often the children are mentioned by name, or the grown-up children, so that you would think, well, if that was the narrator, they wouldn't be mentioning, themselves in a third person way. So it was just meant to be this weird experiment. Then I thought, well, it's been done. Jeffrey Eugenides did the Virgin Suicides, and then we came to the end, Josh Ferris. So,
Yes.
people have tried to do this before.
Father used to love us, he didn't love us anymore, is something that is written. I mean that is heartbreaking.
Those are the first lines. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say, I'm so glad that you thought it was funny because I thought it was really funny, but heartbreaking at the same time. I mean, that line between heartbreaking and funny is the one that I try and walk as much as I can without falling over in either direction. It's not always easy, and I think a lot of people, I don't know, have trouble seeing that things can be both of those things at once, but I certainly do, and when I look back on my work, it seems like that's one of the common threads that runs through it.
Because I think we can all imagine us being in a place, as you mentioned this earlier, where you're in an impossible situation, you're in a conversation you want to get out of. You're at somebody's house and you want to go home. And at some point you say to your partner, why didn't we stay in a hotel? I mean that's just common, right? And then on top of that you have these two rather ridiculous writers who are very popular and you expect would have perhaps a different outlook than they do.
I mean, I really played up authorial vanity and competition. I mean, the two of them, even though they have different spheres and are famous for different reasons, I mean, there's a moment early in the novel where the vicar has come for lunch,
Yeah.
and Anderson, I mean, and Dickens has to introduce Anderson, and if he had introduced him as "This is Hans Christian Andersen," the vicar would automatically know who he was. But instead, he says, "This is Mr. Anderson, who could be anyone." And the vicar has no idea again who he was, and he does it on purpose. And Anderson knows that he does it on purpose. So it's one of these little kind of, I don't know what, underhanded competitive things that I think, the people do, writers do, art, that just is a way of, I don't know what, establishing dominance, I guess.
And he lets the vicar know that he is Hans Christian Andersen.
Yes. And he says, "I'm not only a children's writer, I write for adults as well."
The idea of the voices in the book, sort of the beginning, the middle, and the end, told from different perspectives. Did you come to that early on, or did that develop over the writing of it?
It developed over the writing. I mean, for one thing, it was so terrifying to write something from the point of view of Charles Dickens. I mean, to even try to imagine what Charles Dickens was thinking, considering, the incredible genius he was, that I knew that I couldn't do his section from the first person that it had to be a close third person. And originally, I wanted to sort of avoid saying Dickens, but that was impossible. And then Anderson is so isolated and so interior. I knew that I had to do his section from first person. So because no one else knew, including the other narrator, there might be what he was thinking or what he was feeling, except himself.
And in that section, he comes off much more, and this is at the end of the novel, but he comes off much more, at least in my view, much more clear-eyed than perhaps you would have expected.
And sympathetic. I mean, that, I
Yes.
have to say, I really loved all the characters in the novel. I mean, even Dickens, who was horrible to his family and brutal to his wife by the end, I just felt so much feeling for them and so much, again, sympathy for them. Anderson, it was easy because he was in a way, a way as the sort of victim of all these things that were not in control. On the other hand, you come to stay for a week and you stay for 5 weeks, you're not entirely a victim here. There's something else going on. His dream was that somehow, because he was lonely, I mean, he spent his entire life really being lonely. His dream was that he would be somehow magically adopted into the Dickens family and become a member of this big Victorian, apparently, supposedly joyous family that he'd heard about or thought about. And in fact, he came at a moment when Dickens himself was sick of the family, when the children knew the family was falling apart, where, Catherine Dickens didn't get out of bed for days or weeks at a time. So, this dream he had of the adopted family who would take him in was just always a fantasy.
What was it about, I guess both of them, but let's say, what was it about Catherine Dickens that she eventually comes to want to have a more, let's say, certainly a more honest and open relationship with Anderson than anyone else in the novel?
Well, that was entirely made up. I mean, we'd have no real evidence that that happened, but it was extremely convenient for me because I needed a way to get Catherine's voice into the novel and not just leave her, as a sort of the woman weeping behind the closed bedroom door. So when I realized, I mean, she spent, I mean, she, with all these children, I mean, there were 12 births, 9 kids survived, one died quite young, and then two miscarriages, I guess. And after each one, she had what we would diagnose now as a severe postpartum depression. But that, this was before things were diagnosed in that way. She was just lying in bed and eating cookies all the time. I mean, that was her life. And every time she would come down to be with the family, there was some sort of minor disaster. I mean, one of the things that was true in the novel is that at one of these formal lunches, she finally came down to lunch and dropped her ring into the soup. And it was this massive drama, and the servants were all called to fish out of the soup, and soup all over the tablecloth, and it was just horrible. And Dickens wants no part of her. The children are so used to her misery in a way, except for the youngest. They're accustomed to just walking right by her door and hearing that she's weeping inside. But Anderson, because partly he's a newcomer to the house and partly because he has really a sympathetic nature, is the only one to knock on the door and say, "What's wrong? Do you want to talk to someone?" And so, in her conversations with Anderson, is the only way I had, and the incredibly convenient way I had of getting Catherine's voice on the page, of telling her side of the story, or what she was feeling, or what she was going through, and what that marriage was like for her, which just could hardly have been more awful.
The name of the novel is 5 Weeks in the Country by Francine Prose and is published by Harper. The comet on a collision course with Earth, and this is something that you incorporate into the novel. Give me a sense of what brought that to be something that would, in many ways, tie some of these loose ends together.
Well, it was true that in 1857, in July of 1857, a comet supposedly, I mean, this turned out to be completely bogus, but supposedly was going to just destroy the world, just hit the world and that would be it. So people believed this or people didn't believe this. And it was another way of expressing the characters of the novel, because Dickens, of course, being sort of a scientist and his friends were scientists, just never believed it and told the family that this wasn't going to happen and so forth. And Anderson, being much more fearful, was terrified that this was going to happen. In fact, you know, before the very first working title of the novel was The Comet, because I just wanted that sort of sense of imminent destruction or not to be hanging over the novel. And then, as I say in an end note, I just kind of stole big chunks of it from that Lars von Trier film, you know, Melancholia, where there's a comet about to strike and Kirsten Dunst is lying in the grass waiting to be obliterated, you know, whatever. So it just sort of gave me a visual image of what that might be. And I saw a comet. I saw a comet last summer. I saw it near Rhinebeck. I mean, I have witnesses. There was a comet that,
Sure.
there was a comet that you could briefly see. And we were driving sort of to the station in Rhinecliff, and there it was. Just and everyone was saying, "Well, no, you know, it's just a contrail from a plane and blah blah," but it didn't move. It just was there. You know, we stopped, and it just that was the comet. So I felt it felt like a sign.
You get some sense of the output of both of these authors from the backgrounds that you describe. I guess probably more with Anderson than you do with Dickens, but you understand where the spark that ignites their great work does come from.
If you even know a little bit about their lives, you can see, if you want to, parts of their autobiographies all the way through. I mean, so much of Dickens's work is about secrets and secrecies and things that people not knowing things. And he kept the facts of his childhood, I mean, the fact that he'd grown up in the prison and was so poor, a secret from everyone except his wife and one friend. And it was only on his deathbed that the family found out about it. Likewise, Anderson grew up in poverty. His father was a cobbler. I noticed at some point that that one of the peculiar things, I mean, his father was a cobbler, and there are several Anderson's fairy tales that wind up with the main characters getting their feet cut off for, you know, whatever reason. So, you know, I'm not Dr. Freud, but they both had these fantastic imaginations. I mean, incredible imaginations, and the ability to just let their imaginations go. I mean, to just invent characters in these wild situations. I mean, Dickens was, I guess you could say, a lot more of a realist. I mean, that is, the social conditions of London and England were much more a factor than they were in The Little Mermaid, let's say. But nonetheless, they're both highly imaginative and wrote these works of just wild imagination.
Part five of the book is The Tears of the Comet. And Anderson wrote a work, The Comet. Did that inspire you? How much of that did you actually take? What did you want that to be?
I didn't realize till later that he'd written a fairy tale called The Comet. That was just an accident. I mean, I wanted something that I felt was redemptive, really redemptive, to happen near the end after all this suffering and trauma in the house. The thing about the fairy tale that Anderson, that is me, writes, The Tears of the Comet, you don't have to look very hard to see that all the embarrassing, mortifying, unpleasant, uncomfortable experiences that he had in the Dickens household were woven into this fairy tale. So he makes this kind of glorious, beautiful work of art, really, out of the detritus of its daily life and so forth, which again, you know, that's kind of what we do. I
Right.
mean, you know, one of my sons said, you know, you write so much about the family, but no one would ever know that you do, except unless you know us really well. And actually, not while I was writing it, but when I've been talking about it since then, little bits of autobiography will come back to me, and I'll realize that there are things that are based on things that happened to us that have gone into the novel, and I just had sort of forgotten. I thought I was making them up.
You talk about in writing the second part of the book of not wanting to write in Dickens's voice, but was it intimidating to write as Anderson writing one of his fairy tales?
Yeah, it was terrifying and scary. But you know, that's part of why you would do it, or why
Right.
I would do it. You know, what's the point if it isn't really,
And
you
how do you
know,
get ready for
scary?
that in the sense of is that an immersion process of reading a lot to get you ready to? Because obviously you have an idea of what you want to convey.
I'd read tons of Anderson, and also The Snow Queen, which is my favorite Anderson story. I taught it maybe three or four times. So I had a good sense of sort of what, you know, how a narrative would work for Anderson. But really, I wrote it like everything else, which is like I write one line and then I write another line and then I write a third line based on the first two lines and then see where it goes. So it wasn't planned. It was just like it started off and I knew it was going to be about a comet and I knew that it was going to incorporate much of what had happened so far. So it was just about finding a way to make all those things, put those little puzzle pieces together.
I'll end with this because one of the things that surprised me was that A Christmas Carol was so, in the novel, is so defining for Dickens and how people knew him. And I guess I didn't realize that. I thought that came later, even after his passing, that A Christmas Carol became such a touchstone.
No, he was thought of even during his lifetime as the man who taught England how to celebrate Christmas. So his connection of Christmas was intense and all the way through. In the Bird Collection in the New York Public Library, they have Dickens's performance copy of the Christmas Carol because when he would go out and do these public readings, often it was a Christmas Carol that he was reading from, and they were like, there were cuts in it because he couldn't read the whole thing, and then little notes about gestures he wanted to make. But I mean, it's a great story. We every Christmas in December at Bard, we read it aloud. There's kind of faculty and people in the administration and so forth, and students come and other people come. Even though I've read The Christmas Carol a million times and I've heard it for years now, every year, there's this line which is something like, "And Tiny Tim who did not die." And so it says, and every time it's like Pavlovian, just tears pop into my eyes. Tears pop in. I know perfectly well it's coming. I know what it is. And yet I have some, it's purely Pavlovian. So it's very powerful. The only thing that's sort of sad is that if you look at what he's saying in the story or novelette, wherever it is, to not be greedy, to think of others, to help the poor. To think about all the people who've read this story and how rarely the precepts of the story is advising have been actually carried out in real life. But you keep hoping that someone will read the Christmas Carol and go, "Oh, I don't want to wind up sad and alone like the ghost of Christmas Future shows Ebenezer Scrooge. So I think I'll just help the Cratchit family and give away some of my money."
Right. I think we all have that person in our life who we wish was visited by three ghosts in the night, right? I mean,
Yeah, and many people in the world, let's just say.
yes, absolutely. The name of the novel, 5 Weeks in the Country. It's published by Harper. Francine Prose, I love talking to you. Thank you so much for being with us. What a delight.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Once again, Francine Prose is the author of the new novel, 5 Weeks in the Country, published by Harper. Thanks to our producer, Madeline Reynolds. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.